Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started. Hey everyone, stay tuned to the end of the interview where I'll give you some actionable insights that I learned from my guest. These insights will also be in the show notes. As always, thanks for listening. Now, on to my guest for today, Indiana Indy Gregg of WeDo. Indy has built a career as both a tech entrepreneur and a singer. She made a name for herself in tech when she set out to fight music piracy. As a musician, she believes musicians and other artists should be paid for their work. As a result, she founded Kernoots, a platform that paid musicians when their music was downloaded, a forerunner for today's streaming music platforms. Indy's most recent venture is WeDo, a neobank for the freelance economy. Consistent with her mission to ensure people get paid for their work, she sees WeDo as a platform that breaks down barriers for entrepreneurship and freelancers by providing access to the tools today online knowledge workers need, like platforms that help them deliver their services and actually get paid to do so, which is really cool. We've seen some of these things start to pop up, so this is going to be really neat to talk with her about that. So now, let's get better together. Indy Gregg, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jari. It's great to be here.
It's great to hear you and hear your background of all the beautiful birds chirping over there in Spain.
The Indy Spa.
Yeah, the Indy Spa. We talked about that a little bit before we started recording. I love that calming sound because, you know, during the summer, birds wake up early. And if you're a light sleeper, like you wake up when the birds wake up and usually that's, you know, dusk or dawn or whatever, right? Anyway.
Or the roosters.
Or the roosters, right? So it's just really cool. And I'm glad we could connect because it's really fascinating, you know, what you're doing right now over at Neobank and WeDo. And, you know, you're a musician, I dare say rock star. You're like my second, maybe third rock star I've had. I think second legit like rock star. And I'm always fascinated by people that take their creativity in one area, one genre, and move it over to another area, another genre. And, you know, what you're doing over at Neobank, I just think is really darn cool. And I cannot wait to, you know, dive all into that. And it does have a lot to do with what's going to happen with capitalism in the future. And just like, there's lots of things changing in the world. And I think you're at the nexus of how this is going to work. But before we get all into all that sort of stuff, as I always like to say, why don't you tell me how you got to do what you're doing today?
Wow. You know, life has a really long journey and there's lots of windy roads that bring us to wherever we are in our lives. And I think it's really important to pay attention to the wins and the losses. And, you know, I'll be 50 in August. So I feel as though I I can talk about that a little bit more than I could back in my years as an early entrepreneur. But I come from the creative background. I've always been inspired by technology. And I started 5 different businesses. I've been a founder multiple times, and I worked consulting startups. So what you're doing in promoting entrepreneurship is really of great interest to me. And I really think there needs to be more people spreading the word and helping the next generation of entrepreneurs. But I come from, a technological background. Probably one of the biggest things that I achieved in my kind of career path, aside from rock stardom, is actually fighting pirates. And the whole point of fighting the pirates was to level the playing field. So out of that kind of conundrum, I had that history of going up against the Pirate Bay, and then eventually the government started to pay attention to us and to me. And we launched a platform called Kertunes. And this was really in the early days of MySpace. So it was before you had iTunes and Spotify and other solutions. And we kind of had to be groundbreaking in terms of really understanding that you can't just let musicians and artists and, people creating, movies, film producers, not be able to monetize their goods and just sharing it as if that was okay to do. And that was some sort of a promotional thing. That wasn't going to work, because creativity needs some capital. And whether that's human capital or monetary capital, it still needs some capital in order to survive if you want quality, right? So we launched Kertunes. We had 14.5 million users. We had labels. We had publishers. We had tons of awesome artists. And it was really, we didn't know where we'd end up, but it was really important to take a stand. And what came of that is afterwards, I got really involved in helping founders and helping startups and helping young entrepreneurs. And it led to, my new project, which is We Do. And that's how I got here today. Lots of winding roads, 3 kids in between that. Now they're all grown up and lots of other stuff. But life does what it does.
So. Yeah. Well, I'm 52. I turned 50 in February. So
there you go. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah. Well, you look back, what's sort of interesting, because I always tell people, in my 50s, I want to pay off all the hard work I did in my 30s and 40s. And they're like, what do you mean by pay off? And I said, well, there's a couple of things, right? Obviously, I need to eat. Well, I probably, if you hear this show a lot, the money aspect of being an entrepreneur is not really what I'm in it for, right? I think a lot of entrepreneurs are in it to create, to like build an independent world that completes them. I love freedom. Like for me, it's like the freedom to do what I want to do. I will almost be in poverty to be like not telling me what to do. So, so I can really resonate with the fact that, artists need to get paid. I think, the whole Napster stuff, and even Metallica back in the day when they were fighting Napster and, all the rights and the piracy, they were, of course, Metallica was the biggest one and the Napster thing was the biggest one, but it is nice to hear that there were other people sort of, maybe not as prominent or at the time were just still grinding away, because I think that importance of the monetary value of art and an artist. And, a lot of people say, well, and some artists don't like the business side of making their art. Mm-hmm. Right. And even authors, I know a lot of authors, and boy, they're the worst at it. They will write 100 billion words and none of them will be publishable and no one will read their good stuff, because, once you write the book, that's half the battle. The other half is getting people to read it. And I'm 100% convinced on this, that any creative endeavor, the amount of time and effort it takes to create whatever it is, you should spend the same amount of time, effort, and money to promote and sell what it is. And a lot of people are like, Jari, just go viral. And I'm like, it's not going to work. So, wow. there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, so let's talk about We Do, because that's very innovative when it comes to this whole idea of getting freelancers, people that create things, getting them paid on a platform that's fair. And because there's a lot of these platforms, even the hardcore financial incentives that are against these kind of things coming up and having, you know, kind of power to the people, so to speak. So tell us a little bit about that and kind of what you're working on.
Yeah. So for the last year, a little over a year, we've been developing a neobanking system that's cross-continent. So we're regulated in the United States and in Europe and the UK. And fundamentally, we decided to take an approach of what if a bank could offer a seamless software as a service platform for free? And what do they need? So freelancers are online all day, every day. A lot of them are service providers who provide content to their end clients and customers through webinars, through live face-to-face meetings. They're delivering their, you know, services pretty much live. And so we kind of took a look at that and thought, well, you know, if half the world by 2025 are going to be part of that gig economy, the freelance economy, and you know, just this past year, that was a $1.2 trillion market in the United States. The way I was looking at it is, you know, how do you remove the barrier of entry? And with a pandemic like COVID, for example, in this scenario, a lot of people lost their jobs and many, many people are hurting. And how do you level the playing field and give people opportunity without putting roadblocks in their way? And when you think about the average, say, virtual coach or whatever, they are, you know, they have a lot of barriers to entry. First of all, price. It costs money to actually have a Zoom account and do things professionally. It costs money to invoice people, to have QuickBooks or to have Calendly and all these tools that people use. And that all adds up. And if you remove the barrier to entry and give them a free entryway where they can actually perform and deliver the help that they need to do to help people, educate people, do whatever they do online, you remove that barrier and you give them a free way to earn their living, we don't need to charge them. We can just simply let them bank with us. And so that what that does is cut out the middleman and give people a safe space to operate. And then, you know, we can build more tools on top of it. So it works pretty well.
Interesting. So basically building a freelance artist bank, I guess. Would that be a good characterization?
I guess more like building a bank that supports the creative economy. So, you know, most people, like if you sell anything online, you're going to pay 2.9% plus 30 cents to Stripe or PayPal or somebody, right? And what sites like, say, Upwork or Freelancer or People Per Hour, or any of the freelance sites do is they take a commission on your earnings. And a lot of times that's 10%. Other platforms charge you. It's pay to play with like Udemy or a lot of the education platforms. And there's no need to do that. Freelancers have it hard enough. They have gaps in the timeline from when they start a project into project, you know, and it's very difficult for them to, you know, to survive if someone's taking a 10% cut, plus they've got to pay their taxes. There's all sorts of things. And if you're charging them on top of that to use a service when there's actually no need to, you know, I always say, if you want to beat the bank, you need to be the bank. So creating something that's actually conscious that will actually work for the people is really important for me. You know, if we're delivering more entrepreneurs who are delivering more help to the world and creating knowledge bases and exchanging knowledge and, you know, gifting their expertise or charging for that expertise, if that's helping to elevate other people in their lives, their business, their mental health, whatever it is they're providing, then, you know, that's a first step to helping to make the world a better place. Secondly, you know, the freelance economy is great in terms of the impact that it has globally on, you know, our cities, on the air we breathe. Less people in traffic jams, more people working from, you know, remote places and not moving around quite as much. That does have a carbon impact, you know. So, yeah, that's where we are today. And hopefully it has an impact on millions of people. And hopefully it helps those people help more people. And if we start doing that, we're going to have a better planet. I mean, that's just the way, you know, that's the way the world works.
Right.
And I'm hoping that, you know, people receive it and enjoy it and give us feedback and can make it better. I mean, we're a tech company. So, and then we have all the infrastructure from the banking system. We have four American banks who are behind us and a couple in Europe and one in the UK. So we're, you know, we're pretty well covered in terms of insurance, the whole FDIC, everything to do with banking, reconciliation. You know, one of the guys who founded this work is on the founding team with us is David Jakes, who is the founding CFO of PayPal. He was a treasurer of Silicon Valley Bank. We have Dan, who was from Citi, ran family offices. We got a really amazing team. Samantha Glover, who's our information technologist, just really brilliant people just started to say, hey, we like this. We're going to join you. We didn't have any money when we started. I'm just saying, entrepreneurs, you know, there's some sweat, you know, we paid our dues before we, before we had any money in the till. So, but yeah, it's been really fun. It's been a great journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a boss that used to say, never let money get in the way of progress. Just,
yeah, you can't, you know,
because
you just can't.
A lot of times the money lags the idea, the genesis of it, you know, I think.
I agree totally.
Yeah. It's just interesting because that's, It's fascinating that you're building a bank, you know, and having a different model as opposed to a service fee, you know, like, okay, pay this percentage. You're just like, well, no, the deal is you bank with us. We make money off, I'm assuming, the interest in loans and whatever kind of infrastructure. I don't know much about banking, but what I do know is, yeah, they've got all the money. They seem to make it all too.
Well, we don't even need to do that. We don't have to exploit people. We can be very ethical and still do better off than your average SaaS. And then on top of the software as a service model, you know, with premium, when you're making money and we can create better tools, you may want to upgrade and we can make your experience even better, the way you serve your clients better. But there's a baseline for equalizing the playing field for everyone. And, you know, I feel as though we're going through a transition in history right now, where technology is really exponentially having an impact on our lives and the way we communicate and the way we serve each other. And as automation goes forward and we're dealing with, you know, a lot of artificial intelligence, a lot of robotics, knowledge exchange is going to matter. And it doesn't matter what kind of knowledge. You could be a guy who knows how to dig a well, you know, somewhere in, say, Africa or in India, or knows how to like take care of sanitation or water sanitation. You might be sharing your knowledge to the next village or the next, you know, whatever that development cycle is. Most of them have a mobile phone. No matter where you are in the world, that's the one thing that connects most of us, and they have access to their mobile phone. So sharing knowledge and being able to monetize that should not be a barrier to anyone. In fact, I think it should be a human right, to be quite honest. I mean, I feel as though that's, everyone should be have at least the opportunity to earn a living and to sustain themselves well. And we're hoping that we're part of that opportunity.
Yeah, there's I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but there's a group here in the US called Right to Start. And I'm going to, I totally forgot his name, and he's going to get mad at me. No, he's a nice guy, but, him and
you can drop it in. Like,
yeah, I will. Yeah. I'll be like, and it's insert name here. So Right to Start. I got introduced to him through John Deary, who is the Center for American Entrepreneurship, which he's so interesting because he's not an entrepreneur. He's a policy guy, but he's running the Center for American Entrepreneurship as a startup. And what I found is just like so fascinating is there are, I think, and you probably see this, and I think the world sees this, and it's creeping more and more towards this. Well, where being able to start a business, you actually have to have some amount of privilege. That amount of privilege is socioeconomic knowledge, whatever it is, that there's something that there's a barrier to entry. And this barrier is, the government makes this barrier. It's one of the interesting things.
Through education.
Well, yeah. Through education, through laws, through lobbying, like in the US, right? Like, do you really think that the drug company, like they all say, oh yeah, this whole drug discovery thing is so cumbersome. Oh, we need to have less regulation. They're totally full of shit because they benefit tremendously from having this brick wall in front of all the little players, right? And
yeah,
that's the most extreme example, but you can just roll that down to other little things. Like here in California, you know, if you want an LLC, it's like an $800 tax, just $800. Like, it's just, here you go. Well, that's, you may think, crazy. Well, $800, that's not that much. Well, yeah, if you're just starting out, I mean, that is like, there's just certain, they don't, it doesn't scale right. You know what I mean? And
and
Right to Start, as well as the Center for American Entrepreneurship, what they're trying to figure out is what are the laws and structural problems in the US, specifically in the US, that prevents people from starting businesses. And the most important one is what you guys are working on, is access to capital and banking infrastructure. And so this is one of the most critical things, because you go to a traditional bank and you're someone that doesn't have any credit, you have this new business idea, you know, they say, oh yeah, show me your business plan. You're like, business plan? What the heck is that? Because honestly, you don't really need a business plan if you're like a freelancer and you're like, hey, I know how to dig well. Example, I know how to dig wells. Like, I say, hey, you need a well? And they're like, yeah, here you go. Here's some money. Okay, I'm a business person. You will never get any working capital from a real traditional quote unquote bank with that kind of, no way. Yeah. They won't, they'll be like, who are you? Right?
So
it was the access to capital and banking infrastructure, and then education.
Yeah.
Which was the things that actually you would think the most entrepreneurial country in the world is actually not that good at. Actually, Europe and some of the Scandinavian countries are better. So I'm wondering, so you're going to build this bank. I think you're going to launch it in the September timeframe. Are you going to then, as this process, like build up like the education process, like these things that really, you know, I can give you the opportunity to bank, but I also need to teach you a little bit about like, what does this mean?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, a lot of people don't realize that they can go ahead and trade as a freelancer without having a company to start. So, you know, you can give yourself a brand and all the money it takes to actually start a real business, an LLC or a C corp, or if you're an S corp, if you're an organization, whatever that is, you can get started. And as long as you're paying attention to, you know, the costs and you're keeping a record of that, you can convert that into the business as, you know, expenses and expenditures that you know, against that business that you start, as long as you do that within a timely manner, that all counts. So one thing that's really important, though, that a lot of freelancers don't do is they use a personal bank account rather than a business bank account. You don't have to have a business number. You don't have to have a Delaware C corp or whatever it is, you know, an LLC in your state to start separating those expenses from your personal account into your business. And so, and just that simple education is, you know, if you're paying things from your personal account, make sure you keep a record of it, show that that's part of the business, keep a tally on that so that that all counts towards the investment you've made into your business if you are spending money on it. And what we're here to do is say, hey, if you run a service business or you sell something, you can sell it live in real time, take a payment, ship your goods or ship your service or perform your service through our online SaaS, and also create a community around yourself and monetize it, you know, and really share knowledge. And you can do that for free and, you know, and work with, you know, the goods and the following that you've already developed maybe on other platforms. And, you know, we're agnostic. You go and bring people along from Instagram or send people to Instagram or send people to other platforms. You know, we don't care. We just want you to be able to monetize. And we want to provide a system through which that if you did eventually, you know, start earning like a really decent sizable income and you needed a loan or you do need mortgage, we can connect you to ethical lenders and put you on a better financial trajectory And, you know, we're already working and talking to people who are in this, you know, kind of field of financial education. I was talking to Nina Fernandez the other day. She started up something called Seed and Legacy, where she's really lobbying the government to create a financial education in, you know, primary schools and secondary schools. And it needs to start from an early age to educate people on how to run their own business, because entrepreneurship is not going away anytime soon.
Oh no,
it's just unsustainable. Oh, no. We don't have big enough, the old factory system moving people through, it's just no longer going to happen, you know. And jobs are important. So creating your own job, or, you know, using, and this is a great opportunity for people to capitalize on their passion, to really go deep into what do I enjoy? What kind of knowledge transfer can I do? Or what good or service can I provide? And how can I get that word out? You know, I think we're in a really great period of history where a lot of things are accessible. We just need to make them more accessible and educate people.
You know? Yeah.
So I think love what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. Well, yeah. And well, I appreciate that. That's very kind of you to say. I also, what's interesting is I had done some research on business formation. Like, so for all you like history nerds out there, the first corporation in the entire world was created in 1600. That was not first corporation that was not from a king. Was in 1600, and I think it was the East India Trading Company. First one that sold stock, so 1600. And then there was this boom in quote-unquote businesses and stuff, right? And that boom continued on until about 1970, 1980, where the amount of businesses were actually decreasing that were being started.
Right.
And it troughed in 2000, roughly. This is US or no, actually I think it's generally. And so what I've noted, like, so there was this consolidation of labor and creativity, and you can see this in productivity, right? So what happened with productivity, the manufacturing, the plant worker, the productivity of the Industrial Revolution up until, you know, 2010 was 10xing. I mean, it was just incredible how much more productive people would be. But they weren't really getting paid like that, right? The corporation, and you can see it, the corporation was taking all the money. And what you're talking about with knowledge workers, this is the next productivity wave where there's going to be an inflection point. Like, who gets the productivity, right? Is it big company or is it the individual? And my personal belief is it's the entrepreneur, it's the, you know, I believe in the sovereign.
It needs to be.
Yeah, it needs to be, right? I believe in the, right. I believe
that, that goes for data, that goes for, you know, it has to be. That is the only solution. If we don't empower the individual, we're not going to be able to produce the type of economy or the living standards that we once saw. And we're not generating a better world for our children or posterity if we're not protecting the individual. I fully believe in that. There's a place for corporate, you know, corporations. There's a place for big industry. You know, and we're seeing that already in social networks and, you know, the mining of data, but that data belongs to you. You're the individual. You should have insight and leverage in your personal life in order to create a better society. Otherwise, this disruption, this disconnect, this kind of bipolarism that we have in society today, that will continue and we'll destroy ourselves. You know, I mean, that's the reality. And we're going to have to come together and realize that very quickly. And I think that even governments must be aware of that. If they can create better GDP from citizens who are happy, healthy, and owning it, we're all better off.
Yeah. The people at the top are not necessarily, that's the reason why there's so much downward pressure. You know, you can see that. You can see that in the, even during COVID, which we're still in, but like the insanity of the stock market and all of this, like completely asymmetrical. Of course, some businesses completely cratered, but some were just 10, 20xing what they're doing, you know? And I like your thought process on this, because I believe in like the sovereignty of the individual. And what that seems a little kooky, but basically, I feel that people should be able to have an independent life that completes them without the constraints of, you know, undue kind of process, or, you know, we need some rules because, and I'm not libertarian or anything like that, but we need a framework. I always like to say we need government to say, what are the rules of the game? And we all got to agree on the rules, and we all got to play by the rules. And you don't see that with big corporations. I mean, and time and time again, I mean, that's the reason why the entire G7 was trying to figure out, well, we need some sort of minimum corporate tax because it's the shell game. They're just moving money around and we're all not bent on, you know, it's not cool. And this attitude about business and entrepreneurship and this maximizing shareholder wealth stuff, it started in the 70s, 1970s.
Yeah.
Before then, you know, business people were part of their community. They benefited their community. The community looked up to them. The community gave them the opportunity and a little bit of leeway, you know, to kind of like go out on a limb and do some stuff and then say, it's cool. Like, we get it. But that's being taken advantage of in a huge way. I mean, it's crazy, right? And I agree with you. I think people are going to be like, I own my data. I own the output of my labor. I mean, there's always those things where you don't own, you know, you don't own the output of your labor, but it's not true. I don't think to your point, you don't want to create some art and then someone steal it and you not get paid because it's easy to steal. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, society has been conditioned that digital art, digital content is free.
Yeah.
And
there's nothing wrong with it being free to an extent, but, you know, there still needs to be a leveling of that playing field. And I think, you know, there's a certain amount of art and music and everything out there that you can offer for free to a certain extent, but maybe a live performance or that you're doing online virtually, you know, you should at least be able to create streams of income for yourself if that's a value you're providing to society, you know. And education is a big one. Education is a huge one. That transfer of knowledge, you know, if teachers are all starving to death, where is society going to go, right? I mean, let's think, you know, it's reality, right? Coaching, teaching, tutoring, any type of knowledge transfer that makes someone's business more efficient, life coaches, mental health doctors, lawyers, accountants, all of these people are knowledge transfer, you know, businesses. And a lot of them are solopreneurs. A lot of them are, you know, freelancing, and a lot of them are, you know, they need a way to deliver their services. And we just don't have a very streamlined approach to that. And that goes back to empowering the individual. They're not big companies like Apple or Facebook or Google or, you know, Hewlett Packard or whoever, you know, is out there, Microsoft. But they are people who provide very, very, very fundamental and important services to society. And we can't allow or condone the breakdown of that just because, you know, shareholders are king. I think you can have both, and I think you can create win-win situations for everybody without sacrificing the health and the joy and the happiness and the, you know, the livelihoods of individuals. And that, I think the power to the individual is very important, and that will help sustain even the corporates. The more knowledgeable they are, the more investors you're going to get. And, you know, that grows. We're heading towards what, 7.5 billion soon, and then, you know, we're growing exponentially. So there's going to be plenty of money in the world. Like, nobody's got to worry about that, you know. And there's going to be corporates, and there's going to be new technology and innovations that come through. But we just need to make sure this wide gap and this kind of, you know, economic disparity isn't such an issue. And it really is a huge issue. I mean, there are people really hurting, really hurting. And in the most, you know, financially advantaged country on the planet. I mean, come on. America's like pretty much like the winner of capitalism all across the board. So there can be a bit more leveling there. And I think it's very, very fundamental to how we see our future, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was the Center for American Entrepreneurship that did a study on net positive job growth, like what drives actual creation of jobs. And it turned out it was startup companies in the first 5 years, create all the net positive jobs. They net positive. Mm. Big corporations were net negative.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, you're right. Right.
And
it's paring it back. You're too fat. Pare it back. And that causes layoffs, or they're shutting down plants because it's not economically viable. It's better off in China, in Asia, you know.
Well, look at it now. Like, you can't do that anymore. This is the thing I think that really solidified it for me when it came to offshoring. Cause I mean, I was a semiconductor engineer. So I used to work in the semiconductor business for like 20 plus years. So we all did all our fab in Asia because it was just cheaper, right? And we had some fabs here in the US. And back then we had about 30% of the world's manufactured semiconductors were done in the US. Okay, 30% is not great, but the rest of it was Asia. Literally Taiwan, China, Singapore, Korea, you know, Japan, but like hardcore China and Taiwan. Now it's 10%. Of the world's semiconductors made in the US. And you wonder, well, why are all these shortages of semiconductors? Well, there's a lot of reasons, but primarily it's because the demand, like when the demand goes up and you only have like a few players, right?
Yeah.
There's no competition for supply. Like, so you can't supply it. So prices go up. It's obvious. And I know now a lot of times, the government now is trying to figure out how to bring semiconductor manufacturing back, which seems, it's an expensive endeavor, but it's one of the most automated ways to make something because you have to, you have to be in a clean room and usually you want to use robots, but it's a very highly skilled manufacturing process. So the whole argument that it was cheaper in China and Taiwan was just laziness to be 100%.
Especially if they're manipulating supply and demand, because you're going to pay for it in the end, you know? So I think that was a big problem. You know, I guess if you think back to the Reagan Thatcher years, you know, offshoring a lot of manufacturing in the United States and especially in Great Britain, the kind of the outcome of that, you know, at the time we're like, yay, go, you know, go Reagan, go Thatcher. But then the aftermath of that, moving away from, you know, kind of those staples of American job culture, big shift, you know? I mean, I know we had that movement of technology in the .com afterwards, and, you know, we are where we are. But when you look back and, you know, bringing it back home, when we kind of created this kind of hunger in China, it's just, you know, where capitalism needs to get a little bit more conscious about, you know, what moves we make and when, and understand, I mean, we got to protect our people, you know, and we have to do it.
It's competitive.
At the expense of the tiny guys, at the expense of the little guy, you know, in a lot of cases. You know?
My friend Phil Dillard, he talks about this. He calls it fourth sector capitalism, and he's pretty much an expert in fourth sector capitalism. What he's trying to figure out is building the processes and the infrastructure to create fourth sector capitalism in all of these places in the country that don't have manufacturing's gone and it's kind of depressed. Because what his thesis or the hypothesis of fourth sector capitalism has to do with nonprofit, for-profit, and government coming together to create a local ecosystem or a local community where it's sustainable and thrives in its local area. So now, doesn't mean global trade's bad. I mean, actually, free trade is good when it's actually free trade and not subsidized. The reason why everything is so cheap from China is because we don't tax it or levy it. It's a whole complicated mess. I mean, part of the reason I'm like, macroeconomics is a bunch of bullshit. I think it's like all about the local, you know, I mean, and of course people give me bash, you know, what do you know about economics? Well, not a lot, but I know what doesn't work. And it seems to me that we got to focus on our local communities and build strength in those local communities and be resilient to local problems. Just look at when that ship, you know, botched up the Suez Canal. Like, the entire world shut down for like a couple of weeks because one stupid ship got sideways. All commerce stopped.
It's crazy.
I mean, this is stupid. Like,
and that's why localization is so important. Yeah, it is. 100%. It's stupid. It's ridiculous.
And again, yeah. I'm not saying.
A friend of mine, yeah. The government's trying to fix that. But yeah, it's crazy. A friend of mine is working on opportunity zones, and that really nails straight into what you're saying about local, yeah. Like going local. And at least now, you know, that legislation has gone through about opportunity zones. So property investors can invest in local buildings and get them relatively cheaply and be subsidized to help build up local communities. And I don't know if you've heard about it. I think it's under the Jobs Act even,
yeah,
where they're
I've heard
starting
a little
development
bit
in the United States.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And yeah. That those entrepreneurs need banking and education and someone to take a chance on them. Because so for me, I always think like this entrepreneurship is like pulling balls from an urn, right? So if you've got a decent level of competency and a good job, I mean, a good idea, like, and you hit the bar, I always say you hit the standard, you go over the bar, like you're over the threshold, whatever it is, I don't even care what it is. My whole hypothesis is you take all the names of those companies, you put them in it, you write them on a little ball, you stick them in an urn, and you randomly pull balls out. And that's what you fund.
Yeah.
And everyone
like
will be
like,
yeah, right. And everyone's like, oh, well, Jari, you really just don't understand venture capital. Like we do a lot of hardware. Like, no, you don't. No, it's random luck. So stop like thinking you're all high and mighty. It's luck. You could probably get 80% the way there, but that other 20% is market timing, team, luck, hustle, absolutely out of your control. I mean, hustle, maybe not, but
yeah.
You cannot guarantee an outcome. You can only put in your effort to make it happen, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just like pull balls out of an urn. Like, what does it matter? I get a little.
Yeah. Well, I think though, you know, with venture capitalism or any type of investment that you're making in a new entrepreneur, or going back to like kind of the focus of the young entrepreneur or new entrepreneurs is grit matters, grit and value. And, you know, you need to be believable, and that has a lot to do with your purpose. If, like you were saying earlier, if it's all about money, you were talking about, you know, money isn't, you want freedom, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get an entrepreneur, they have a sense of purpose, that there's a reason behind what they're doing that makes them get up every morning and pound the pavement and go for that, then you're going to have a higher chance of success. But you're right, it's still placing on a bet. And, you know, venture capitalists hedge their bets. They're going to get so many winners for so many losers. And you need, as an entrepreneur, you need to fail sometimes. It just don't spend a lot of time doing it. Do it as quickly as possible so you can learn from it and then move forward. And there's a lot of value to that. But you're right, VCs, you know, they're investing money. They're doing it across a, you know, a portfolio. And you just... It's difficult, but you know, there's some out there that are striking pretty high and some of them that aren't. I mean,
yeah.
Well, so some of them do have it down to some sort of a science. I don't know. Right.
If you look at the majority and they do all these studies, a lot of them don't make a return, but that's because it's a hard thing to do. Like, again, it's a little bit of luck, there's skill. I mean, there's skill in everything. I mean, I think the way I always like to think of it is like effort matters, and you can put out perfect effort and not get any results, but without perfect effort, results will never happen. So it just won't, because you only control the effort you put into it. Like there's some things that are just going to be against you. And I think that's some of the reason I like what you're doing to try to remove those barriers so that everyone has a level playing field. I would say fair playing field would be, I think, the word I would use, because when everyone's sort of like at the same fair level playing field, or just they're playing by the same rules, then you start to see a lot of this, luck and stuff happen into it. And I think a lot of people get nervous with that. They're like, oh, you mean I'm not as talented as I think I am? That's part of the reason all of these laws exist. I mean, honestly, like that's why all these lobbyists spend lots and, you know, billions of dollars getting laws passed that they're like, well, we had to make sure that this was, you know, competitive. And you're like, no, you're rigging the game.
Yeah, right.
Because you got the money and you can't tell me you're not, because you've got the money to do it. So,
I guess that's one of the advantages, though, of a big country like the United States is where you do have lobbyists, you always get a pushback. So there is a push and shove involved in it. Mm-hmm. And we always hope that eventually we'll come out sort of even though sometimes it feels like the odds are against us, you know, depending on where we're entering the market or what we're doing. So, you know, that's one of the, I guess, one of the wonderful things about a democracy or living in a republic where, you know, you have those pushes and pulls and the people's voice matters. I mean, you got that going for you. So that's good.
Well, I mean, that's why everyone, when they look at the United States, it's like, well, it's like these 50 states bound into a loose republic with quote unquote weak central control, and every state's run like a little country. I mean, literally, yeah. It's like the Wild West chaos monkeys. I mean, it really, like, they, you can see that in just how each state dealt with COVID, because every state is responsible for their own response. It's up to the governor. I mean, the governors have a lot of power, right? So we have done 50 different experiments on how to deal with COVID. Some people think that's crazy insane, right? Yeah. Americans are crazy and insane, and we're a bunch of independent yahoos. Like, we don't like to be told what to do. We're like the ultimate, right? That way. But the thing that's interesting, right, is that we have the freedom to move between states. If we don't like something, we can move. But each state is all these experiments. So what works in one state, of course, may not work in another state. And of course, people's lives are at stake, but that's the way it's set up. And the unified theory of, oh, we're going to just unify all this stuff. That's all that stuff is. These are our recommendations. Now, the federal government can, like, withdraw federal funding for certain things, but generally they're pretty autonomous. So, but it's funny because, it's just this massive experiment that we hope doesn't go off the rails.
It is crazy though, you know, because most people don't see the United States as that. It's kind of packaged to us. If you're overseas, it's packaged to us like in through Hollywood or through a movie. Yeah. And then like we just get like the headlines from, you know, coming from Washington, D.C. or New York or California or Texas. And people forget there's like, you know, 46 other states in there that they all have like different ways they deal with things. You know, sometimes someone will ask you a blanket question. It's like, well, what are the laws on this in America? And I was like, I don't know. Which state are you talking about?
Yeah, which state? Which
the laws in California are totally different than New York, than in Louisiana, than Kentucky or Illinois. I mean, it's, you just don't know. But we all feel like, as Americans, we all feel like we're part of this, you know, homogenous country with the same ideas, or, you know, like the same systematic brainwashing, I guess, or whatever it is.
Well, I mean, it's bound by the Constitution, right? I mean, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is probably, like, I would say, you know, the nexus of it, right? E pluribus unum, right? Like, from there come one. It's interesting because we just have a different attitude about it. I mean, we are a country of immigrants. Mm-hmm. We're immigrant first, even though we bash them. That's how we grow. That is how this is a success. No other way. Everyone has come here from somewhere else. And honestly, over time, we're just all going to realize that we're just, you know, we're all Americans. But it's just interesting anyway. But, you know, Indy, it's been great.
The entrepreneurial education, though, for those immigrants. And that's why I really love what you're, you know, what you're working on here with your podcast, Jerry, is that is the one thing that can be done across all 50 states is actually provide that education and more and more. You know, I think it's also mentorship. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurs who are at the age maybe that we are, the information we can pass on to the next generation. And that's why I love what your podcast is all about. That's so important. That's so critical. And more people need to just take some time out and help educate that next level of entrepreneur and just let them learn from our mistakes so they don't have to go through quite as many, because God knows they're going to have tons of hurdles right?
Make your own. Don't make the same one that crazy Uncle Jari and crazy Aunt Indy made. Make new ones. It's been great talking to you. I really appreciate it. This has been so great. I love it. We didn't even talk about like you're like a rock star and everything. Maybe we'll get to that another time.
We'll invite you over to our podcast as well, Jari.
That'd be great.
It's been wonderful.
Appreciate that. Really been great. You know, good luck with your launch. Good luck with what you're trying to do. Stay in touch. Let us know how we can help. And yeah, we'll talk later.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jay.
Thanks, Indy, for being on the show. That was a great conversation. Like I think I told you before, you're the one of only two or three rock stars I've actually had on the show. So thanks again for being on the show. Now, as promised, here are the actionable insights that I learned from my interview with Indy. As a seasoned entrepreneur in different industries, Indy believes in sharing her experiences and knowledge, but she says, be ready to make your own mistakes. And this is totally true, right? I mean, this whole show is about educating and inspiring the next generation of entrepreneur. But I can tell you, there's some things you're just going to have to learn on your own, right? Marvin says, the brick in the face. You sometimes need that in order to learn some stuff. Indy also firmly believes that the future is freelance and entrepreneurship, that to make a living, sharing and teaching what you know is a human right. And, you know, I think this is one of those things that we're going to see a lot more of. You know, there was this whole movement called Right to Start, and there's obviously the Center for American Entrepreneurship, which I've interviewed John Deary about. So I think there's this huge movement towards this. It's a very powerful movement, and I think a very powerful thing. Indy's experience also demonstrates that you can build a business based on principles. Kahoots began with a desire to take a stand against piracy. We Do, similarly, is based on a belief that entrepreneurship should and can be available to all. And I might have screwed the name of that first company up, but I put a link in the show notes. You can take a look at that. Really kind of fascinating, right? That this is like the first, you know, that one platform trying to figure out this piracy thing back, you know, back in the day when all the other free sites, right? So it's really powerful to have principles, and you can really tell that in the interview. So there you have it, the actionable insights that I learned from Indy. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur and, frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.